Good morning to you all. Good to see you all, visitors and regulars alike. If your Bible isn't open to Matthew chapter 2 yet, I encourage you to make your way to that spot. That's where we're going to be as we dive into the story of Jesus in the second chapter of Matthew's prologue, which I would include Matthew 1 and 2 both in that. Let's think about the way that the Messiah entered the world and the circumstances of it. You know, history is full of great conquerors and leaders of men. You can think about Alexander the Great, you can think about Hannibal, you can think about Julius Caesar, you could think about World War II generals, you can think about William the Conqueror, Napoleon, people who won brilliant battles that are still studied in military textbooks to this day. But in Matthew chapter 1 and 2, the greatest leader of men, the greatest general, the greatest person in world history, he was born in weakness into the world, but obviously in the course of the story, he becomes the conquering king. It's often said that you don't get to pick your parents, but Jesus did pick his parents. He constructed his family tree, and as we saw from last week, the family tree that he constructs is pretty shady, pretty humble, full of people that you would not typically, as a Jew, want to point to and say, "I descended from that person right there." Even the ones with great titles and great nobility, like David, second king of Israel, even he fathered a son by the wife of Uriah the Hittite. And there we see that in Matthew 1. So Jesus enters the world through a weak family in a lot of ways. He enters the world in weakness in a lot of ways. But even in his infancy and his toddlerhood, he has the invincible protection of Almighty God. And so chapters 1 and 2, especially chapter 2 here, is setting us up for the rest of the book, where we are pointed to basically three things. That number one, Satan is doomed. Satan's going to throw the kitchen sink at Jesus, even from the beginning, and he can't seem to make his plans come to fruition. So Satan is doomed. Jesus is going to win, but he's going to win through weakness. And we see people like you and me who are not Jews are welcome to fall at the feet of the King of Kings. So notice those three things as we move into today, but also as we move into the rest of the gospel that comes after chapter 2, because that's the story of Jesus. All right, so let's look at the first 12 verses here, and let's notice some interesting things about what Mickey read for us. Notice that news of Jesus' entrance into the world, it provoked two very different reactions. So on the one hand, you got people who are just overflowing with joy. You got the verse 10 people. But then you've got the verse 3 people, and news of this king is actually a cause of great trouble for them, for Jerusalem's power structure, which at the top, King Herod is evil, and chief priests and scribes are probably not too great themselves, if they're anything like the people who were in place 30 years after this moment. I think it's important to really closely examine this story, because this might be one of those stories with the Magi coming to see Jesus that seems so familiar to us that its strangeness has sort of dulled and wore off, maybe for us. Who are these guys? Really, who are these guys who come knocking at Joseph and Mary's door? We're told that they are magicians, magi, astrologers, sorcerer-type people, and they're from where? The East. Now, Judea, in terms of the Roman Empire, Judea is about as east as you can get. So I'm assuming they're from Persia, they're from Babylonia, they're from some other area outside of the empire that is known for its wise men who look at the stars, because that's what they said that they've been doing. That's why that they're here in Judea. But I don't know a lot of details about them. Are they Jewish converts? Are they proselytes? We're not told that in the text, where they're presented as astrologers, magician, magi. How did they know from watching the stars that the king of the Jews has been born in Judea? I don't know. I wish I did. How did they have the certainty to take this long trip from wherever they lived with extravagant gifts in tow with them to come and say to Herod, not is he here, but where is he? Did you notice that? They don't go, you know, we've been looking at some charts, and we've been looking at things up there, and we think maybe, so we showed up on the possibility. No, they say, where is he? Because we know he's around here somewhere. How did highly educated, non-Jewish noblemen decide to fall down at the feet of the king of the Jews? I don't know the answer to all of these questions, but I believe that all of this happened because Matthew said it did. What I do know, though, is there are two contrasting reactions of the news of this Jewish king. And so verse 3, the current puppet king, Herod, is deeply, my translation in the ESV says, troubled. You could also translate that as something like terrified. Now, this is an interesting guy here. King Herod had killed already, by the time this happens, King Herod had killed his favorite wife. And he had also killed two of his sons because he was an absolute paranoid person, afraid constantly of losing his power and his life. Supposedly, the Emperor Augustus actually said about Herod, I would rather be his pig than his son. Because if you're in a Jewish world, your pig's pretty safe. Nobody's going to kill and eat him, but you might kill your son if you're in Herod's family. So how do you think he took this news? And how do you think the rest of the city took this news? Did you notice what is said there in verse 3? King Herod was troubled, but also not just Herod, all Jerusalem with him. Maybe because there's some wicked people kind of like Herod who are at the top and they're worried about their position and their power. But maybe it's just that, well, King Herod is a loose cannon. He's got a lot of soldiers. We don't know what in the world he's going to do if he gets really, really upset because he does crazy things we've seen before. But in verse 10, the reaction of the Magi, who came with this news that the king was born, when they find the star, they find the place, they find Jesus, notice verse 10, when they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. Matthew uses repetitive language to get across the idea that they are over the moon. It's about as strong as Matthew could say that. I think Jesus' good news is always going to have this same dual effect on the hearts of people who hear about this king. So if your life is about you being king, if it's about you calling the shots, if it's about your money and your time and your relationships are all revolving around your preferences and what makes you comfortable and what you would like to do with your life, and God is, you want him to be this distant afterthought, this part of your peripheral vision, then that means you're not going to be joyful about Jesus. You're going to be troubled. You're going to be terrified by him. The promise that he makes to transform your hearts so that you become a completely different person with different priorities and different goals and different ways of going about living and thinking in the world, it's going to be terrifying to you if you want to be your own king. But if you want to give that up, if you are tired of trying to rule your own life, you're tired of the slavery of sin, you're tired of being disappointed by people who rise up around you and say, I'm the answer, and they're not, then finding Jesus is a cause of great joy because he is the tender and strong monarch that we're all looking for, even if we don't verbalize that to ourselves. So we got joy and we got trouble. And I want to focus now on the Magi themselves, in contrast to the lack of reaction amongst the Jews. So these Gentiles come from this, wherever they come from, this great distance to worship the king, while knowledgeable Jews who knew where the Messiah was supposed to come from, they don't seemingly do anything about this news. But they know where to send the Magi. Herod gathers them all together. By the way, it seems that because the text says that he gathered the priests and the scribes, priests are Sadducees, scribes are typically Pharisees, he gets both of the sects of the Jews together, maybe not even in the same room, but he consults both of them and says, where are they? What is this all about? And they've got the answer for him. I mean, they can trot out Micah 5 like the best of them. It's Bethlehem. Bethlehem was the place near where Rachel was buried. Bethlehem was the place where Ruth met Boaz. But Bethlehem, most importantly, was the place of David, where he was born, where he was raised, where he was from. And so the Jews, the Jewish leaders, they knew all about Bethlehem. But for whatever reason, and we can speculate what those reasons might be, nobody went there. It's just the Magi who are going there. Do you know how far Bethlehem was from Jerusalem? It's either 5 or at the most 6 miles, depending on where you put your start point and your end point, how you measure that distance. 5 or 6 miles. I think Josh and Ty could run that in no time flat. I don't know how long it takes you guys to run a mile, but probably not very long. It was practically over the next hill. Can you see why Jesus would slap his forehead later on in the gospel story when the Jewish leaders would look at him and go, "We'd like a sign from heaven, please. You show us who you really are." When it is evening, you say, "It will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, it will be stormy today, for the sky is red and threatening." You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times. Matthew 16, 2 and 3. A sign from heaven? There was a sign in the heavens. At the moment that Jesus came into the world, and they didn't go and chase it. Numbers 24, 17, a star will come out of Jacob. A scepter will rise out of Israel. The chief priests and scribes knew all this, but they didn't go. In the book of Daniel, the magicians, the magi in the book of Daniel, are bumbling idiots who cannot read the writing on the wall when it's right there in front of them, cannot interpret Nebuchadnezzar's dreams, but clearly not all ancient magi were bumbling idiots. Clearly these guys, I don't know what they were doing, I don't know what they were studying, I don't know how they got to the information they got to, but they got there, and here they are in Judea. They are more in touch with the Messiah of God's people than God's own people are. That's embarrassing. I think this calls for some deep humility. When we think about application now, This calls for some deep humility on our part. Maybe you have friends who call themselves witnesses of Jehovah. And they are deeply wrong. I believe that they are deeply wrong about many things. The deity of Jesus Christ, Christ as God being one of those things. But man, are they more evangelistic than you are? They're out there knocking on doors. I don't think we were in our house 2-3 months before they come and knock on our door wanting to have a Bible study with us. We had a Bible study with them. Do those people have more of a drive to make sure that the people who are around them in arm's reach understand their faith? Do they have more of a drive to do that than we do? To make sure that the people around us know that we are Christ followers and not just nice, kind people out there in the world? Maybe you have Mormon friends who I believe are following the writings and the teachings of a false prophet, but are they pouring more time and energy into trying to shape the hearts and the minds of their children than we are? It is so easy to rest in our rightness and just ignore the star that is hanging over the next town that other people are visiting more zealously than we are. You probably have friends who are part of a church that isn't teaching the truth on baptism. You probably have friends who are part of a church that is not using its money, its collected funds, in ways that Jesus would approve of. But do those friends know their Bibles better than you do? Are those friends marking up the book of Haggai with pencils and highlighters, and maybe you barely know where Haggai is? Do those friends have a better understanding of open-hearted kindness and hospitality than you do? Do those friends know about forgiveness and mercy better than you do? Some of the best material I have ever come across on the subject of forgiveness was written by a pastor of a church that I could personally never work with and recognize as a brother, and yet I think he understood Jesus' teachings on that subject better than some Christians I know. What I'm saying is I think every one of us needs to take a hard look at our own hearts to allow for the possibility that there might be magi out there who don't have it right on a lot of things, but who might be more in touch with the workings of God and His character than some of us are. We need to be humble about that. If it's true of you, then you need to get yourself to Bethlehem and go follow that star just like them. Something that I think is really neat about the Magi, and I want you to hold your finger in Matthew. I want you to go to Isaiah 60. I'm going to give you a minute or two to get there because I really want you to see this. I think the Magi and their gifts pointed forward to the richness of the kinds of people coming from all the nations who are going to flow into the kingdom that Jesus has come to set up. I want you to look at Isaiah chapter 60 toward the end of the book. We're going to read the first 7 verses together, and I want you to hold Jesus' story in the background of your mind as we do this. So verse 1, "Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you." Kind of like a star, you might say. "For behold, darkness shall cover the earth, and thick darkness the peoples, but the Lord will arise upon you, and the glory, His glory, will be seen upon you, and nations shall come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your rising." So over and over it's said right there, light is going to erupt out of the darkness, and prominent, important foreigners are going to come streaming to it like moths to a flame. Except in this case, they're not going to get burned up when they get there. I want you to notice 4 through 7 now. Lift up your eyes all around and see. They all gather together. They come to you. Your sons shall come from afar, and your daughters shall be carried on the hip. Then you shall see and be radiant. Your heart shall thrill and exult, because the abundance of the sea shall be turned to you. The wealth of the nations shall come to you. A multitude of camels shall cover you, the young camels of Midian and Ephah. All those from Sheba shall come. They shall bring gold and frankincense, and shall bring good news, the praises of the Lord. All the flocks of Kedar shall be gathered to you. The rams of Nebaioth shall minister to you. They shall come up with acceptance on my altar, and I will beautify my beautiful house. So people are coming from a distance, and they're coming with some of the same gifts that are mentioned in the Matthew 2 story that the Magi came with, and they're coming with news. They're coming with praises to God. I love that. When we go to Matthew 2, that's exactly what we see happening there with these guys. They come with these extravagant things that probably paid for the trip to Egypt that Mary and Joseph were about to make as they fled the land. But they also brought with them the news of the king when they came into Herod's court. This is just an extraordinary passage that, again, sets up the whole rest of the story. That is, the kingdom is for guys like this. Kingdom is for people like you and me. Kingdom is for all that Jesus is creating. But before the start of the kingdom, we've got to make sure that we keep the son safe who's going to bring this kingdom in. And so that's what happens here in this passage throughout this chapter, and even chapter 1. We see a long series of dreams. 5 different dreams, in fact, coming from God, placed in the minds of different people that emphasize he is active. He is not taking his hands off the wheel and just hoping that this sets itself up. No, he is active, and he is not going to be stopped, not even by a clever Idumean king, Herod. In the history books, Herod is actually called Herod the Great. He's not called that in the Bible, but in the history books he is, and not because he was a great person, but because he accomplished a lot of things that you could put on a resume if you're talking about great kings. His family was originally from Idumea, so which means he was an Edomite. He was related to Jews, but he's not really one of them. He comes from the split between Jacob and Esau. But I think it's fair to say that outside of King Solomon, he was the most energetic and impressive builder king that Palestine had ever seen before, maybe since. He, as you know, constructed the great temple in Jerusalem, made the Jews really happy. He made all kinds of desert fortresses like Masada and Herodium. He built the coastal city of Caesarea just out of the sand. He just went there and said, we're going to have a big seaport, and there it was. So you go to Israel today, and there are so many impressive ancient ruins that have his name on them. But as impressive as he was from a worldly perspective, despite all of his resources, despite all of his brutal manipulations, you notice how in the story here in Matthew 2, he totally dupes the Magi. Like he's got them. You go, you do some reconnaissance, you come back to me because I really want to worship him too. They totally bought that. But he could not, despite all of his ingenuity, he could not kill Jesus. God was going to make sure of that. What we see happening here is a retelling of the Exodus story with Pharaoh. Do you remember at the beginning of Exodus when the Pharaoh who comes to power, he doesn't remember Joseph, and he looks over at the burgeoning Israelite families, and he says, we got to take care of this, and he concocts this plan. Let's kill the newborn baby boys. And who does he recruit for that job? It's kind of dumb, but he recruits the Hebrew midwives. You do this for me. And the Hebrew midwives kind of fall down on the job. And Pharaoh calls them in and says, how come these baby boys are still alive? And the midwives go, oops. What do you know? Well, it turns out that Hebrew women are more vigorous than Egyptian women are. And those babies just pop out before we can get there. Sorry. And so he gets thwarted in his original scheme. And so he retools, and at the end of Exodus 1 into chapter 2, he concocts this new plan. He does succeed in starting to murder innocent children. And there in chapter 2, verses 1 through 10, we notice, though, he fails miserably to kill the future deliverer of God's oppressed people. And so what we see here in Matthew is just a retelling of what is going on here.
So I'll say a couple more things about this. What I did want to point out was the way in which Matthew 2, we see a lot of prophecies being brought up by Matthew. Usually when somebody's trying to rescue an area or be a deliverer for a people, that people's going to show gratitude. That is not the case with Jesus. In verse 6 of Matthew 2, we ease into the idea that this Messiah who's coming is not going to be revered. His birthplace is spoken of there in Micah chapter 5. In Micah 5, Bethlehem is too little to be counted amongst the clans of Judah. But that's where the ruler is going to come from. In verse 23 of Matthew 2, even says, the prophet said, he shall be called a Nazarene. There aren't any cross-references in your Bible that say he's going to be called a Nazarene. But what you will find in passage after passage in the Old Testament is that the Messiah is going to be despised. He's going to be rejected, even by the people closest to him. So Psalm 22, Isaiah 53, Psalm 69, just to name a few.
So I think that's what Matthew is saying. He's tapping into this broad theme that the king is going to come, the people are going to mistreat him in a lot of ways. And Nazareth was despised, was rejected. Nathanael, John chapter 1, can anything good come out of Nazareth? And Nathanael was a Galilean where Nazareth was. But also the deliverer side of the Messiah is brought out here too in Matthew 2:15. He quotes from Hosea 11, which is talking about God leading his people out of Egypt. And at the end of Hosea 11, there's a roar from God as he's gathering his children again. In Matthew 2:18, he's quoting from Jeremiah 31:15, kind of a sad passage. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and loud lamentation. Rachel's weeping for her children. It's probably talking about when the Babylonians gathered the exiles right before they were going to go into captivity. Ramah was kind of a launching spot near Rachel's tomb. And so Israel's history was full of tears. And Matthew 2 is just one example of that. But at the end of Jeremiah 31... that same passage where he's quoting from ends with, there's a new covenant coming. So Jeremiah 31:16 says, keep your voice from weeping, your eyes from tears. There's a reward for your work, declares the Lord. So to wrap this up, as we said at the beginning, this is what Matthew is setting us up for in the rest of the gospel. That Satan is going to try his hardest to get in the way of God's plans. He keeps trying to find the soft spots and throw all his power against that, but he's not going to succeed. When you go to Revelation, We see the same picture here. I'm going to read Revelation 12, 1 through 6 as we close. And a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pangs and the agony of giving birth. And another sign appeared in heaven, behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on its head 7 diadems. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. And the woman stood before the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. She gave birth to a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. But her child was caught up to God and to his throne. The woman fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God, in which she is to be nourished for 1260 days. I don't think Revelation 12 is just talking about Matthew 2, but Revelation 12 is kind of surveying a very large section of Bible passages where God's plan comes in weakness and Satan tries to pounce on it. But, like in the case of Moses, the baby is born, and the baby survives, and God's plan goes forward, even though it looks like God's people are outnumbered and outmaneuvered, and the dragon's going to win. The dragon is not going to win. God has made sure of that. So this is just a micro version of what we're going to see in the rest of the story. I can't wait to study the rest of the book with you all. Thank you for your attention today. If you need to tell us about your life this morning and how you need to draw closer to this king that we've been talking about, because you know that there's sin in your life, and you know that life is fragile, and you know that any moment might be your last. If we can help you in any way today, let's stand and let's sing the song that Byron selected for us.